It's a bit bright up here. I can go blind. Either that or I need my... It's just... Yeah, it's a little bit better. Those are, man, that's bad. I have to get my cap on up here. The Angel Tree distribution, they need people to help deliver the Angel Tree package. They're all wrapped and ready to go, right? And that's going to happen on Saturday at 9 a.m. That they need people to deliver this stuff. Okay? Mark, you want to say anything else? That's also going to take place Sunday after church if there's stuff left over, right? So they... Everybody's business is nobody's business, so they need people to show up to help deliver this stuff. Okay? And if they don't get it done, then we'll do it again on Sunday. Okay? I'll take care of it. We should probably pray for this. And get started. Let's pray. Lord, I ask that you would speak to us tonight as we look at the kingdom that never happened, that possibly could have, but didn't happen. And help us to see what that means in terms of our own lives. Maybe we can learn a few things from a bad example tonight, and that's Absalom. In Jesus' name, amen. I want to talk to you. I started this last week at the end of this when we were talking about the friends of David and things like that. And we began to work on Absalom a little bit. The fact of the matter is every one of us here has our own little kingdoms. We are in our universe. Each of us have our own lives, and we have people around us, and there's other kingdoms around us, and they rub up against us, and we have things that go on. We have families, and we have all kinds of things that happen within the context of family, circumstance, situations, bad blood, good blood, that kind of thing in terms of that. And we've been looking at David, and actually we looked at Saul too, because we all have kingdoms. And what I wanted to do is make sure that we pay attention to what happens in these kingdoms, because even though the technology is different, humanity hasn't changed at all over the years. And so we're looking at them as kings and queens of our own kingdoms and trying to get some perspective on what that means in terms of our lives. Tonight I really want to look at Absalom a little bit. What might have been, you might say. It's the kingdom that never happened. There are six chapters that are devoted to Absalom in terms of the Bible in 2 Samuel chapters 13 through 18. And if you look at those chapters and what he did, his story unfolds to us. And he is a person who is not a man after God's own heart. He is a man who has evil in his heart. In chapter 13, we see where Tamar, his sister, is raped by his half-brother Amnon. And he develops a very hostile situation towards his brother, and he plots against his half-brother Amnon, and he finally ends up killing him with a conspiracy to get that done. In chapter 14, and then he runs. So then he runs away from the king, and he runs to his grandparents' house. In chapter 14, he does some conniving on the inside, and he makes sure that he can get something done, and he goes in and he takes care of getting himself back into the city of Jerusalem, and in terms of that, and Joab gets him restored to the kingdom in terms of where David is. In chapter 15, he begins to seize the throne by taking over and doing some things in terms of that. And by the time we get to chapter 18, that's where the rebellion takes place, and he's a temporary overthrow, and he leaves. David is has to leave Jerusalem and runs away, and then it happens that he gets killed. I want to talk to you about some of the things that he does that are, well, they're not principles, but they're aspects of a person who does things against the will of God, and I want to show you those. So I talked about the first one last week, and that's a person who usurps the power of somebody else and actually takes the God's order of things and just works around the edges and unseat somebody in their own way, and he takes them away from where they need to be. One of the things that that points to is that a person who does that kind of thing are guaranteed a short rule. When we talk about it in terms of how God works, the purpose of God in our he has for each of us in our lives. When you think about the story of David, who do you remember, Absalom or David? Well, we know about David. Absalom could have been an heir to that kingdom. He stole it for a short period of time. He usurped it, you might say. But you don't remember Absalom's story. He's not the one that is mentioned in church much. It is David who is always mentioned. The other one, the son that is mentioned of David, is Solomon. And Solomon comes along and is placed in that. Now, I want to read to you from 2 Samuel chapter 15, verses 1 to 12, and just kind of walk through this. Now, we've worked through this thing from the aspect of David, but we just started last week doing it from the aspect of Absalom. In chapter 15, it says this: after this, Absalom got himself a chariot and horses. This is after he gets restored to the kingdom in Jerusalem. One of the things that he has not known, he never met with his father. After this, that's when he's restored. Absalom got himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way of the gate. And when any man had a suit to come before the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "From what city are you?" And when he said, "Your servant is of such and such a tribe in Israel," Absalom would say to him, "See, your claims are good and right, but there's no man deputed by the king to hear you." In other words, he said, "Hey, if I were king, I would take care of you, but since I'm not," and so he was undercutting the rule of David. Absalom said, "Moreover, oh, that I were judge in the land, then every man with a suit or cause might come to me, and I would give him justice. And whenever a man came near to do obeisance to him, he would put out his hand, take hold of him, and kiss him." Thus Absalom did to all of Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. What he's doing is he's undercutting the rule of David. This would be like in the modern days, somebody who's undercutting a boss or something in a business. Or it might be a brother or a sister who undercuts a brother or sister of theirs in terms of a relationship with a parent or something like that. That's what's going on here, and that's what Absalom is doing. And he's doing it intentionally. The man knows what he's doing. The reason I know that he knows what he's doing is he plotted to get to kill Amnon. And he's quite astute at this. Verse 7, at the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king, pray, let me go and pay my vow, which I vowed to the Lord in Hebron. For your servant vowed a vow, which I dwelt at Geshur in Aram, saying, if the Lord will indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will offer worship to the Lord. Then the king said to him, go in peace. So he arose and he went to Hebron. Now what he's done is for 4 years, he's been undercutting the kingdom of David. And he's just basically doing that constantly in terms of building up his kind of clientele, you might say, and anybody who is disgruntled with the rulership that's going on, and then he's taking over. But then he gets up and he says, okay, I've done this now, and he's got himself in a place where he thinks he can do something. So he asked David whether he can go down to Hebron. Just do some kind of religious thing. Verse 10, but Absalom sent secret messengers throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then say, Absalom is king at Hebron. By the way, that's where David was king first, at Hebron. With Absalom went 200 men from Jerusalem who were invited guests, and they went in their simplicity and knew nothing. In other words, he's got this entourage that's going with him. They know nothing about this plot. And so they're going. And he goes down there, and he gets, and while Absalom was offering the sacrifices, he sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor, from his city in Gilo, and the conspiracy grew strong, and the people with Absalom kept increasing. And this was going on in terms of that. And we were in chapter 16, 17, 18 was the rebellion and the temporary overthrow. And David has left Jerusalem, and we looked at that. In chapter 18, verses 31 to 33, you have the end of this thing. And behold, the Cushite came, and the Cushite said, good tidings for my lord the king. He's talking to David. For the Lord has delivered you this day from the power of all who rose up against you. The king said to the Cushite, is it well with the young man Absalom? And the Cushite answered, may the enemies of my lord and king and all who rise up against you for evil be like that young man. And the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. As he went, he said, oh, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you. This is the end of that story of Absalom. Now, we're all born into families, and I wonder what our parents thought of us when we were born. Well, I'd ask John, but I won't do that. But, you know, when that baby is born and is brought into the family, do we not have high hopes for that child? I mean, if you're a normal parent, I would say you have high hopes for your children. Well, I am sure that David thought the same thing. He had six children early on, and Absalom is one of those. And where you think, I have high promise in this child. And he must have thought about that in terms of Absalom, because his name is a combination of the word Abba, which is the word that Jesus used to talk to Father God, Abba, and Shalom, which means peace. So what you have here is a combination of Abba Shalom, Absalom, and it means a father's peace, really. And I think that that's probably the way that David thought about Absalom when he was born. He is the son of my peace. And what I mean by that is that things had settled down in his life, and he probably had high hopes for this boy. And we talked about that. And, you know, he had other boys, Chileab. We don't know anything about him. Amnon is the one that was killed by Absalom. But Absalom, he grows up, and he is not his father's peace. He's not the son of his father's peace. He violates the principle. He said he's out to steal somebody else's kingdom. And you know, the devil comes to steal, kill, and destroy. And one of the things about this is you have a man who is trying to steal another person's kingdom. And you know, this happens in our world all the time. And we have wars that go like this over history. But you know what? We have wars in our families, in businesses, in corporations, in churches, where someone is always out to steal somebody else's place. And that's what Absalom is doing here. And I don't know, I'm going to assume that everybody here is good. But I'm here to tell you, we can do the same kinds of things. Have you ever stole anybody else's thunder? You know, have you ever taken credit for something that wasn't yours to take credit for? Have you ever tried to undercut an employee? Have you ever tried to become a boss over somebody else? Now, our kingdoms are very much like these kingdoms. The things that are different have to do with this is a nationwide kind of thing, but I know this stuff. We have stuff in families that takes place all the time. My job is one in which I end up taking tours in other people's lives, and I see and I experience secondhand a lot of times, but sometimes real close to firsthand, the conflicts and the things that go on in the context of families and friends and business and job places, et cetera, et cetera. And we all have our kingdoms, and you have your kingdom, and I have my kingdom. And one of the things that I'm looking at in terms of watching this stuff is, how do you live as a king and over your kingdom? How do you live as one of God's men or women? How do you do that? How do you be a person like David, a person after God's own heart? Or how do you live as a king like Absalom does? And because he did. I mean, there are people out there all over the place, and it's like a big bell curve. And you might have David on one side, but we know how bad he was. And you might have somebody like Absalom on the other end, but there's a big bell curve. And we all fall into this context in different places in terms of that. And in our broken homes and things that we go out there and we just do our thing. And we don't think about the vertical understanding of life. We think about it just horizontally, and we think about it just in terms of people. Do you know that God has an intended sovereign purpose for your life as well as everybody else? And when you accept that basic principle, then you have to start looking at things a little bit more vertical. Absalom is not a man who looked at the world that way. He was strictly out about, it's all about me and what I can steal from David and in terms of my kingdom. And so he usurped the kingdom. Now, we see what the context of that is, and we see the end result of that is that because he tried to steal another man's kingdom, things came apart on him. One of the things that I know, if this has to do with kind of like the principle of the one, if a person will do this to his own father, if I'm around Absalom, I'm going to say, well, you know what? If he would do that to his own father, he would do that to me too. And I think that over the period of time, that's what comes to happen in terms of this. And we also know how David is with people, except when he went sour for a period of time. So usurping another person's place tells you not a lot about that other person. It actually tells you about yourself. The second thing that I talked about was moral sloth, and I kind of stopped here last week. One of the things is we do not do is we don't take responsibility for our lives. And you can call it moral sloth if you want to. We like to sow our wild oats, but we don't want to have to deal with the harvest in terms of that kind of thing. We say, God, I want you to allow what I want in terms of life and all that, but we want him to allow everything in terms of our own lives of what we want, but we then want him to intervene for us, and we want God to rule over the things that are ruining us. In other words, we don't want to take responsibility even in terms of our own lives. We want God to overrule consequences. And I'm here to tell you, you can get forgiveness, but he does not overrule consequences. And it's one of those things that we don't want to learn this truth. And we have it's a moral attitude towards life and things. We want to be able to get away, get that free lunch or something like that, and overrule the consequences. You know, in this country, and especially in this state, because this state of Illinois cannot print its own money. One of the things that is happening in the state of Illinois is there are consequences to our immoral actions and our lack of sense over a lot of years. And it's coming home to roost now in terms of our government in the state of Illinois. And we want God or the government to overrule these consequences. Well, the government's the problem. They have allowed themselves to spend money they didn't have. And you know who's going to get hurt from this? When elephants fight, it's the grass that suffers. But there are going to be consequences, and it will happen. And I don't know how it's going to unfold, but it's going to happen. But we want someone to overrule all these bad, irresponsible actions that have been taking place for a lot of years because of the government. Just saying. And, you know, that's one of the things that's been around in government for years and years and years. But, you know, we govern our own lives, too. And if you live like that, there are going to be consequences to your actions. God may forgive you if you've committed sin, but it's not always about that. Sometimes it's just irresponsibility. Well, the consequences don't get taken away. And this is one of the things that is working in terms of Absalom, and what he's doing is he wants what he wants, and God has no part in it. And yet God is going to have some part in it. The third thing about this is that one of the things that we develop and we is that there is no God, or he's a myth. Or we, in fact, castrate God, you might say, so that he is powerless in terms of our lives. I want you to turn to Psalm 140, 14, excuse me, verses 1 and 2, and there's a statement in here about how we are, and this is the way Absalom believes, by the way, but he's just one of many. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt, they do abominable deeds, there is none that does good. The Lord looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there are any that act wisely, that seek after God. This is one of the things that Absalom does here, and you see it in terms of how he treats people and how he goes after his father. There is no God. God is a myth, and there are millions of people out there that believe this stuff. We have government that believes that. There is no God. He's a myth. Now, I know this about things in terms of life. I talk to people all the time about faith and what that means. But, you know, you have to make up your mind one way or the other to believe in God or not to believe in God. And it's a choice. You have to decide that he doesn't exist or that he doesn't care what you do. Or you decide that not only does he exist, but he cares about what I do with my life, with my relationships and the way I act and all that goes with it. You get to choose. Now, once again, there's this big bell curve out there. And there, you may have somebody over here who is a strong believer in God and wants to do exactly what God has in terms of their lives and their purpose and all that goes with it. And then you got the other end of the thing where a person who does not believe in God at all, and I'm living for myself and it's all about me and I don't care about you. But you have to make up your mind. What do you believe? Do you believe that God exists and he cares about how you live your life? Or is he a myth? And it doesn't make any difference what you do. Well, most of the time, I hope I fall on that side which says, well, I believe that God not only exists, but he cares about what we do and he's involved in our lives. And that's the bell curve, you know, and that's up what I'm teaching up here. But you can go out there on the streets, and you can get the other story right now. Now, you have to decide, and there are times in our lives where we just decide, you know, God's not real. I can do this. And we do it, don't we? You know, Absalom is one of those guys that just decides, I'm going to live my life and I'm going to try and take for all I got. But Absalom could have had it all if he wanted to. Do you believe that Absalom was an accident? That he has no place in God's plan? I don't believe that. I'm a firm believer that inherent in God's purpose is a plan for your life and a purpose for your life, and his power is there for each of us as we live out that purpose in terms of our lives. You know, he was named, he's the son of my peace. And I think that David probably wished that that's where he was. And it may have been that God's purpose was that he was supposed to be his father's peace. But he wasn't. And his was a choice. And he just decided, I'm going to just run my own life, and I'm not going to care about my father, and I'm not going to care about God. And that's the way it is. And we do the same thing. And we can do it in little sections of our lives, or we can do it in large sections of our lives. Or you can go out there, and you can find people right now that are essentially, hey, God's a myth, and this is all crap. And I know that. But Absalom, if what we believe is correct, and if God does have a plan for each of us, and if God is working in each of our lives, and he has a purpose for us, then we're not here by accident. Neither was Absalom here by accident. You fit in God's plan in some form or fashion. But that's, once again, that's a choice that we make in terms of how we're going to live our lives. Are we going to be on the divine agenda where his plan and his power enters into things? Or are we just going to be on our own agenda and we're just going to do it our way? And this is one of the things that you're watching happen here is that you got a bad example of a man who's coming out and saying, hey, I'm going to do it my way. How I'm going to show you how not to live as a king. And we're all kings and we're all queens. We all have our kingdoms And some of our kingdoms are large and some of them are small, but we have them. And how you live your life, you're going to live it in terms of how God wants you to live it, or are you going to do it your own way? See? Three things that we can see in terms of Absalom. He had a conspiracy in terms of his heart. He was always conspiring to take over things. So he was trying to usurp. That's the second thing, David's life. He was trying to steal the thunder of the king in terms of this. And he had unsubmitted eyes. Now, submission has got a kind of a bad name for itself because we talk about it. And it's always come down to, well, women are supposed to be submitted to their husbands. What you're looking at is a bad interpretation of the word. Submission is a choice. Subjugation, you're forced. Submission is always a choice. And by the way, that scripture in the New Testament says husbands are supposed to be submitted to their wives as well. So, you know, it's one of those things. But Absalom was a man who had unsubmitted eyes. He was a child of David. David was the king of the country. He was not submitted to the king's authority. In 1 John chapter 2, verse 16, you get a pretty good picture of how this stuff works. Find it here. In 1 John 2:16, it talks about this. And this has to do with that bell curve again. Are you a man after God's own heart, or are you a man after your own heart and living in the world? And in John is writing to the church. He says, do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, love for the Father is not in him. Now, love, by the way, is what you put your heart towards, you know? That's how you do it. Now, if you're towards the world in terms of your stuff, then, you know, and everything, then that's where your love is. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. Now, that's where Absalom loved. By the way, that's the three temptations. And more than likely, I'm going to take a look at them this spring sometime. But that's the temptations right there. Lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. And these are the things that had Absalom and he was giving into. He wanted what he wanted. And he lusted after his father's kingdom. And the lust of the eyes was involved in that. And the pride of life was, there was no humility in this guy's life. I mean, he was better than his father. He even told everybody that came looking for judgment. He says, hey, if I was in charge, things would be different. And so he has unsubmitted eyes. And you can test these things in terms of yourself, too, by the way. You can also test these things in terms of the people around you. Now, there were three things that happened in a seven-year period. And we've walked through them in David's story. There was a two-year span when Amnon raped Tamar. And Amnon was a half-brother. Tamar was his full sister. And for 2 years, he plotted to kill Amnon. And he finally got it done. Then for 3 years after that, he goes into exile, basically, is what he does. He ends up with his grandparents, his mother's parents. And then he comes back, and there's a couple-year conspiracy takes place in terms of that. And so that's where we were. He basically, if you're a Star Wars person, he goes to the dark side. He allows his heart to be filled with bitterness and resentment and hatred and vengeance. You know, we don't even know how much he blamed his father for Amnon raping Tamar. We don't know any of that stuff, but our minds can conjure up all kinds of reasons why somebody does something, and we do this stuff all the time with people. We assume things that they're thinking, and so we do this stuff, and he allows his heart to be filled with bitterness and resentment and hatred and vengeance, and he goes to the dark side, is what he does. Now, there's a couple of things that we look at. One of the things that you think about in this is about David as a parent. He's got more than one kid that goes bad. Adonijah is another one that goes afoul, too. David, in a lot of ways, is a parent who doesn't rule his house. He doesn't take care of the business of his family because he's so busy doing his job. His job is to run the kingdom. And we know that he does a pretty good job of running the kingdom. But as a father, I kind of get the impression that he's really not paying attention to his children. And these mothers are raising these kids. And really, I think you have to look at the mothers in terms of these things too. Because Chileab, we don't have any problems with that boy. But Amnon had a problem. And Absalom has a problem. They're different mothers. But as a father, I don't think he was paying attention. I think he was busy taking care of the business of his life. You know, I got to go to my job. I got to do my job. And he leaves all the parenting up to mom. Now, I don't know about you, but his authority is he's a king. Okay, and he rules, and he sets the rules. He's a father, and he's probably like most fathers, you know, in terms of this, who they want to be loved, but they don't want to be the bad guy. A lot of fathers don't want to be the bad guy. God, they don't want the hassle of parenting. And I'm going to hear an amen from the women. Well, I mean, it just seems to be that in a lot of cases, it's the man who is the one who says, "I don't want the hassle," and the women are there. Now, occasionally it's the other way around, but not that often. It is not love, though, and this is parenting. It is not love to forsake discipline. It is not love to forsake correction and direction in terms of children's lives. And what we have is we have a society that in a lot of ways is ruled by brats. A child left to himself, or herself for that matter, will bring his parents or her parents shame. Early discipline. I wish I had all the young mothers and fathers in this church at this thing. I know this. Early discipline, early parenting in the first 5 years is probably the most important period of time. Because that's when you're building foundations. And, you know, you got to teach a two-year-old to do things. Or you got to teach a two-year-old not to do things. You got to teach them. One of the things that we did as parents, we didn't put the stuff up. You know, the knickknacks, Patty Black? All those things that sit on the stuff? We didn't put that stuff up. I tell you what, my kids come up and they start messing with that stuff, I'd flick them on the hand and I said, "No, you don't mess with that." And but, you know, they kind of got the understanding of that. Bird do the same thing, except she'd do it a little different than I would do it. Well, we would do that stuff. And I've told this story before, but it's really one of the things. When our daughter Jessica, I came into the room one time and I watched her, and she was standing over by this table. And I don't know what was on it, some kind of knickknack, you know how they are. And she looks at it and she says, "No. No. And she was teaching herself self-discipline. Well, that had to be put into her. The direction was given to her by her parents. But what she was learning was, at two and a half, three years old, I don't know exactly, she was shaking her head and she was doing self-discipline. You know, one of the things that we're supposed to do as parents is we're supposed to help them deal with their self. I'm here to tell you that will destroy a person faster than anything. Lack of self-discipline. And so you have to teach children. It may be cute when a kid's 2 or 3 years old and they do something bad or something like that, but it isn't cute when they're 25. It might be cute when a kid is 2 or 3, throws a tantrum on the floor and says, you know, oh, isn't that cute? Yeah, but when they're 25 and they throw a tantrum, that ain't cool. You have to teach children in terms of self-discipline. And I know that David was out there taking care of the business. You know, he had his business. And he was out there doing the kingdom stuff, and he was going off to war, and he was doing all this kind of stuff. And then, of course, he got in trouble with Bathsheba and all that because he had wandering eyes in terms of things. But we know all that. But in terms of his parenting, I think he left it up to the women. And I know this, that he's the one that's after God's own heart. We don't know that any of these other people were. And I know how humanity gets into us. And he wasn't taking care of business. Now, I know this in terms of parenting, that you have to teach self-discipline into children because they need to learn how to take care and moderate their own lives and deal with the things that come their way. One of the things that I run into down in prison. Now, these guys are all locked up, and so are women, but one of the things I run into is it's not so much the crime that's the problem. It's the lack of self-discipline. They're fine when they're in prison because they are being disciplined from the outside in. But when they get out, they have all kinds of options, and it's the options that's the problem, and if there's no self-discipline, they're going to end up back in there. And I've watched this happen time and time again. And the only thing that's different between us and them is they're a bad example of us. That's all. But they're just like us. But a lot of it comes down to that self-discipline that is needed. And if you don't teach that early on, it's not going to be there because it's tough to drive in traffic, folks. You figure that out, it is tough to drive in traffic. And you hear the haunting words of David, you know, at the end of this whole thing. Oh, Absalom, Absalom, my son. Oh, if I could have died instead of you. And he wants to recover that which is lost. Now, there are two words that I know that are very big in terms of the Christian faith. One is redemption and the other one is creation. It is real easy to create something, a person, but it's not very easy to redeem them. You know? Why? We can create a child, but when that child turns 20 and has had been growing up like a weed, it is tough to redeem that child. Redemptive love is a lot harder than creative love, you might say, in terms of how we live our lives. And so one of the things that I know is when you create a child, you should discipline yourself to discipline that child. And the problem is we want to be loved, don't we, parents? But I'm here to tell you that sometimes you got to be the bad guy in terms of things. And that's not an easy thing to do. You got to be the bad guy. But we're called to do that sometimes in terms of how we discipline children and things like that. And one of the things is that in there is an order to things. In corporations, there's an order. In churches, there's an order to things. And sometimes I've had to be the bad guy and say, no, we're not doing it that way because it's not right. And that makes you the bad guy because whoever wants it done another way. And whether or not that's it, and that's what it comes down to. Sometimes you have to be the bad guy. One of the things my dad, I've learned a lot from him. Anybody, I get in trouble or Jim would get in trouble, he'd come in and he said, but I'm telling you what, I'm not here to be your friend. I'm here to be your father and make sure you get up, grow up right so you can take care of yourself when you get out of here. I am not your friend. I am your father. And he would make it very pointed. And we got the point, you know, because he was very intent, very intentional about parenting. Okay, so anyway, Absalom didn't get that from David. Obviously, something went askew there. So he, one of the things that happened, after he kills Amnon, he goes to Geshur, which means bridge, by the way. And this is in chapter 14. He goes to his mother's parents. That's grandma and grandpa, whoever. Not David, Sponge. Now, he ran away, basically. And I am sure he goes to his grandparents. Now, this is his mother's parents. And there may be stuff going on in the house. You know how this is. There's palace politics that goes on in people's families anyway. And he may have shown up at grandma and grandpa's house. Now, this is not David's parents. This is not Jesse and whoever he was married to. And the webs of intrigue may be involved here. And he said, I can see grandma and grandpa say, tells him, well, Amnon, he probably had it coming. Because Amnon is not related to them at all. Yeah, we understand, Ab. We understand. You know, now, one of the things I want you to, the moral force of grandparents. Some of us are grandparents. And it is a tough thing to navigate that, where you have grandchildren that are around you on occasion in terms of things. And Absalom has his grandparents here, and he's living with them for 3 years up there. Sometimes it's tough. Grandparents sometimes have to step up and guess what? Be the bad guy. And, buddy, that's a tricky traffic to drive in too, is it not? Those of you who are grandparents and you have had small children around you or your grandchildren around you, and they may be more than just small. You know, there's a moral force that goes with us as God's people, as grandparents as well as parents. And I'm telling you what, if I have those grandkids by myself, they will toe the line. And sometimes I've had to bite my tongue around my grandchildren because I have had a child that is there. But it's tough. But sometimes I've had to say, you're not going to talk to your mother like that. Because Daddy wasn't around. And it's tricky. But it's still a place where you have to navigate it. Anyway, Absalom right here, he goes back to the place where his rebellious heart will not be confronted. He goes back to his grandparents. These are people who say, well, you're okay. No big deal. You killed somebody. You're a murderer. It's okay, you know, and how this stuff works. Now, I know this, that I take tours in people's lives, the children of divorced people can run to the other parent and get all kinds of, oh, it's okay, and that he or she are bad anyway, you know. And I know how this stuff works in terms of this, and I bet you two bits, Absalom goes in there and he said, well, it's all right. You can stay here. And one of the things that he does, he goes to a place where he will not be confronted. And that's what we'll do too. We will run to a place where we won't get confronted if we have done something that is not right. The second thing is he goes to another kingdom. This is Geshur. This is the bridge over to the places. This has different kind of laws in it. It isn't the same as Jerusalem. And so he retreats from the order of God's kingdom as well. He goes to a place of self-justification and self-will. Now, don't tell me we don't do that, do we? We will justify ourselves. We'll get off to a place where we can get to that kind of things, where it's kind of like, well, I'm the exception to the rule. Oh, really? That's where people run away from God. And I'm the exception to the rule. And we just don't, and rebellion then becomes self-righteousness. Now, it's very easy for us to see this in other people. It's not always easy to take a good look in the mirror and see ourselves. Now, I've talked about the types of sin before. There are basically four levels of sin. And if you look at what's going on with Absalom, he's in the third and fourth area of sin. The first one is ignorance. You know, I can sin against you and not know that I did it. Because you may have unwritten rules in terms of it. When I have young married people get married, when they get married, they will sin against their spouse because they don't know the unwritten rules. Because this, she grew up under this kind of thing, and so she brings rules to the game, but they're not written anywhere. And he brings rules too, and so you can sin against one another out of ignorance. Well, that's the ones that Jesus forgives. He says, forgive them, Father. They don't know what they're doing. Okay? That's the first one. The second one is disobedience. This is when I come up to a red light and there are no cars within 100 miles of me and I can see anyway and I don't see any cops. And I run it. At that point in time, that is disobedience. I know the rules, okay? But I am going to be disobedient to the rule. The rule still applies. I'm just disobedient. And I've done that when I was growing up with my parents, you know, where you break a rule, you know you're doing it, it's disobedience. The rule's still there. You just do it, right? The third area is rebellion. Rebellion means your rules no longer apply to me. That's rebellion. And take it out of church, because this really needs to come out of church. This needs to be in our daily lives, just relationships with people. The United States of America, with the 13 colonies, broke off from England, and that was rebellion. They said, the king or queen, I don't know who which was, the royalty of England no longer applies to us. We are no longer under your rules. We'll make our own rules. That is rebellion. Got it? That's what rebellion is. That's when a child, 16, 17 years old, says, I'm not going to live under your rules any longer. And they go and they leave, and that's open rebellion. Okay? Rebellion is different than disobedience, because the sin really at that point is that, God, your rules no longer apply to me. That's what it's saying. That's what Satan said. Your rules no longer apply to me. Evil is the fourth group. Evil is when you recruit others to be in rebellion with you.
That's what Satan did. He recruited a third of the angels to be in rebellion against him, and that's true evil. It's when you recruit others to be involved. Now, anyway, Absalom is into the rebellion and evil section of this because he not only is against David and rebels against him and says, your rules no longer apply to me and I'm taking over, he recruits people to go with him. That's what he does here. And he's doing it from a place of hiding, and he's going to sneak back into the kingdom there. Now, the place of hiding, we'll do this too, by the way. You can apply this on an individual basis. This is an individual man doing it. The place of hiding for him was his grandparents' house, place, whatever that was. But it doesn't have to be a geographic place. You can hide in a mental state or just in your mind. Then he sneaks back into Jerusalem, and he goes through Joab to get back into it. He never sees his father's face. He's in open rebellion that's shrouded in conspiracy. He didn't see the face of the king. And it says so. He never got into his presence. He had never approached the king. In other words, he was dealing in rebellion and evil. And he deals very second-handedly with David all the way through this thing. He's coming in the back door to take over. And so he would do this. Now, one of the things that I know is Absalom is a man who does not want to deal with the kingdom. So he doesn't want to deal with David. Now, I can apply this picture because as pastor, I represent God to people. And I have people hide from me. Or I've had people send somebody else around to the side to get in touch with me rather than seeing me themselves. Now, I'm not God, but I represent God to people. And because of that, and if they're in some kind of rebellion or disobedience against God, and they know it, that's the thing, they know it in their knower, wherever that is. What they do is they'll do that and they'll use me as the picture of God, just as he was using David as the kingdom. And he wouldn't talk to David. He wouldn't get in his face. One of the things about, and I have seen this, one of the things about when we do communion by intinction, if I happen to be serving, if you have an issue with me, or if you have an issue with God and you come up to me, it is very uncomfortable for you. I know that. And because I've been doing this a long time, and I have had some people will not take communion because they might have to get into my presence. What I do as pastor is not all rainbows and butterflies. I mean, we're dealing with real people, and some of those real people have real sin in their lives, and they can be dealing in it out of ignorance or disobedience or rebellion even against God, and it happens to do. And then we have all the human stuff besides. And I know this, and I watch this. In this story, Absalom never gets into the presence of the king. And I have people say, well, Pastor, will you pray for me? Why won't you pray for yourself? Sure, I can do that, but I'm here to tell you, maybe you need to get into the presence of God yourself. Don't ask me to do it. If you're not willing to do it yourself and get into his presence, see, that's what Absalom was doing with Joab. He was using Joab to go around the edges so he wouldn't have to get into his presence. And it would steal the hearts of the people out there in terms of the king's court, and that's what he was doing. And then let me read a couple things to you. In 14, chapter 25, now in all Israel there was no one so much to be praised for his beauty as Absalom. This is chapter 14, verse 25 and 26. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. You know, it almost sounds like Lucifer before he was cast out of heaven. And when he cut the hair of his head, for at the end of every year he used to cut it, when it was heavy on him, he cut it. He weighed the hair of his head 200 shekels by the king's weight. He must have had really good hair, girls. I mean, really good hair. You know, and that stuff was there. And so he would probably cut his hair he'd make presents of it to some women or something. Because right after that, it says he had three sons. So I'm assuming that he was obviously involved with the ladies because he was good looking. He had great hair. Clairol perfect and all that goes with it. So then in 15, and he got himself a chariot and horses, and he did all that stuff. And we read that stuff, and he became king in Hebron, and he sneaks into the throne room, you might say. He is not a man of God. And it doesn't take long for people to figure out Absalom isn't the man to handle the kingdom. Three things that come out he's dealing with. First was he's dealing with unforgiveness. He is a man who has to deal with these things. He is dealing with unforgiveness. He knows what Amnon did to Tamar. He must also have some unforgiveness towards his father in some form or fashion, because there's obviously something going on with that relationship. Unforgiveness. Unforgiveness, I don't know think of the worst person in your life. What if that person were to walk in here and sit down right next to you right now? What would it do to you? Unforgiveness. Unforgiveness kills relationships, it kills businesses, it kills marriages, it kills people. He killed Amnon out of unforgiveness, and we know that. If you think of it, our judgment on people keeps us in our own prisons. You know, they talk about forgiveness as being, it's not about so much with the other person, it's about yourself, because not only do you keep them in a prison in your heart, you also keep yourself in prison over them in terms of. And by the way, forgiveness comes only from you. If someone has sinned against you and you are dealing with unforgiveness, there's only one place that forgiveness can come from, and that's you. Absalom was an unforgiving person, and it helped destroy all kinds of things. The second thing about him was he was unsubmitted. He was unsubmitted in his life. He was supposed to be under the authority and guidance of the king, first as father, second as king and authority in the country. But what he did was, because of this, his unsubmittedness in the relationship, in the kingdom and with his father, removed him from the divine order of things. That's why submission in marriages is so important, because submission in marriages helps us stay in God's order of things. And he was not God's, he was not his father's peace, Absalom. He was a planning disobedience and rebellion and all that does. Now, disobedience in businesses, in families, disobedience. I won't even talk about rebellion at this point. Disobedience in businesses, where people don't like the way it is and they want to change things, and so they go against the order of things. You can be in a family, it can be in a business, it can be in a church. You know what it does? It grinds the machinery. And it begins to break things up. It heats things up. And that brings about hostility and all that goes with it. And I know this about unsubmittedness in terms of things. And it grinds the machinery because it's out of order. And I've talked about out of order before. Absalom is like that. He is disobedient to David. Then he gets into open rebellion with David. He is unforgiving in his nature, and we see what happens. The third thing that he is, he's unrepentant. Now, repentant is one of those big words that we use in church. Repentance, actually all it means is to change your direction. That's what it means. I'm no longer going this way, I'm going to go this way. And when John's talking about it, I'm running out of time. We're going to stop here. By the way, we're going to be back January 11th, okay? And since you want to come up here just for a minute, I'll let you say goodbye to people. But we'll be back on January 11th. She's on a pink one.
Can you guys hear me?
Hello? Well, just get, yeah.
I make a promise in front of you guys and in front of God that I will share Jesus and make him known where I'm headed to. I thank you for planting an awesome seed in me that the roots have grown so deep. Because I love this church and I will miss each of you. I thank you, Pastor Jack, because you've taught me things and it's real. And I just wanted to say goodbye and keep me in your prayers, as you guys will be in mine. And some people know how to get in touch with me. And I will check in with you guys through the Facebook. But thank you. Thank you so much for getting to know me on this short journey. I was just a visitor in town, obviously. And God is making a different direction in my life, and I'm okay with that. And I'm strong, and I'm resilient. And I just, again, want to thank you guys. And I will miss you. And whoever got to say goodbye to, let them know I'll miss them. You will be missed. Thank you.
Okay. Let's close it with prayer, and we'll get out of here. Lord, I pray that the stuff we talked about tonight that is helpful for us in terms of how we live our own lives, and that you would guide us in that. In Jesus' name.